Because of the obvious threat to untold numbers of citizens, and because of the crisis which is even now developing, this radio station will remain on the air day and night.
I'm Darren.
And I'm Mindy, and we are the Rants Macabre.
So for this episode, we are going to be talking about one of our favorite movies.
Yeah!
Night of the Living Dead, both the 1968 version and the 1990 version that George Romero produced and Tom Savini directed.
Right.
But I think of it as canon.
I don't know. Is it, what would this, if it was, it's kind of like a fan fiction version.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Yeah. So because, you'd say like AU? No, it's,
because I think George Romero is probably one of his biggest fans.
Yeah.
Like one of his own biggest fans. But yeah, so I'm pretty psyched to talk about this. We haven't actually talked about it since our fourth episode that we talked about zombies, and that was like an extravaganza where we talked about it. Everything from video games to
we did a
TV
lot.
Shows,
yeah.
Like comic books and The Walking Dead and this. But yeah, any opportunity to nerd out more about Night of the Living Dead.
I'll talk about zombies like all day long. All day long.
So I wanted to set the atmosphere. We're going to be talking about the 1968 version first, and it is pivotal. 1968, you know, for those sort of familiar with American history, was a fucking rough year for America. And that this movie fell in October meant that, like, it was a different country from the time they started making this movie.
Right.
So just to give people sort of reminders that April 4th, Martin Luther King is killed by James Earl Ray. King's assassination sparks rioting in Baltimore, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Kansas City, Newark, Washington, D.C., all over the country. June 3rd, Andy Warhol is shot. Late June 4th, early in the morning, June 5th, is when Robert Kennedy is shot by Sirhan Sirhan. August 8th, at the Republican convention, Richard Nixon is nominated for their candidate for president. August 20th, the Soviet Union invades Czechoslovakia, just decides, this is ours now. The Red Scare is strong. August 28th, at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, the police take action against crowds of demonstrators without provocation. The police beat some marchers unconscious and send at least 100 to emergency rooms while arresting 175. And then in October 1st, 1968, Night of the Living Dead premieres.
Put a cap on that year right there.
So, directed by George Romero and written by Romero and John Jack Russo, who's written a lot of books. He's a novelist, and he also went on to write Return of the Living Dead.
And some other treats, some real treats.
Some gems. Santa Claus, like,
every time you say the title Santa Claus to me, unfortunately, like, listeners can't see this, like, little claw thing that you do.
Kitty claws.
Which is more like a little, yeah, like a little kitten swatting at some, like, string. Santa Claus.
It's about right. The movie's seemingly a softcore porn where, you know, not to miss an opportunity, Jack Russo also filmed the sort of behind-the-scenes movie called Scream Queens Naked Christmas, which I thought is funny that IMDb classifies as a documentary. And the reviews make it apparent this is a softcore porn.
Yeah. He also does a film called, like, The Booby Trap, which is boobies. That word cracks me up. In 1972, Romero was being interviewed for Night of the Living Dead, and then this is what he had to say. We had $6,000 and a loose idea based on a short story I'd written, which was in fact an allegorical thing. We decided to take that and turn it into real blood and guts film, and that's how it started. Because there's always this thing when you talk about Night of the Living Dead, it says so much because of the time that this film was placed in. But I always come back to the idea, did Romero really mean it to mean these? Did he mean this allegory, or he just wanted to see some people getting eaten?
So our cast is Dwayne Jones as Ben, Judith O'Day plays Barbara, Carl Hardman plays Harry, Marilyn Eastman plays Helen, Keith Wayne plays Tom, who's a musician out of South Carolina, who on the commentary where the actors participate, he describes himself as a powerlifter.
Keith is Keith, well, not the character.
Keith Wayne. Yeah,
I was like,
yeah.
I don't remember reading.
He's like a young buff guy, but he's like noticeably shape.
They're a very good looking couple, those two.
Yeah. Judith Ridley plays his girlfriend, Judy, and she's got a Brigitte Bardot quality.
She's gorgeous.
On the commentary, actually, no, on the DVD, there's an interview with her specifically, and she talks about how they wanted to really economize everybody's position, and so
I was asked at Latent Image to take a makeup course. They thought that in their production work, that if I could do makeup, that that would be one less freelancer that they would have to bring in. So I took a course at Earl Wheeler, and to complete this course, I had to do a full makeup on someone, and Jack Russo volunteered. I did a complete makeup on Jack. False eyelashes, everything. He was so good-natured about it. He's so very masculine. But I don't think he ever hesitated. He didn't think twice about how it would look. He just said, "Oh, I'll do it." And we did take all the makeup off before.
I mean, it's really interesting that this was a bare bones production and here she was using everything from silly putty to derma wax that morticians use to make up bodies, and Bosco as chocolate syrup for blood.
Excellent.
Because it was black and white, and they could get away with a lot. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more. But the idea that 1968, there was the option, they talk about the sort of cost differential, that they could have shot it in color, but it would have been in 16 millimeter. It would not have looked as good. That it was shot in black and white was a little bit of a throwback, but they got away with a lot more gore.
It really works in his favor, but it also gives it this idea and this feel, which I think we'll talk about later, of a TV show, because a lot of TV was still in black and white.
Okay.
So it gives you this boxy black and white, like you're watching this TV show, and I think it's maybe a little more intimate.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. It's almost embarrassing that it wasn't until this last time watching it that I realized it was in the boxy, it's 1.37 by 1 aspect ratio, which they describe as full frame. So it's the entire film exposure rather than the cropped, sort of panoramic thing that we're often used to with movies. But that element, it lends to the sort of cinema verite feel of like you're looking in a window.
Absolutely. I mean, and occasionally you're seeing the view right over someone's shoulder, literally over someone's shoulder. You're not seeing any fancy smooth cut work, and you're not really seeing any smooth tracking shots. Nothing is really smooth about this, and it gives you the idea, or it reminds me of something like Toby Hooper.
It does feel almost documentary-like. And we, in other episodes, we talked about how Toby Hooper came from a background of that. I will say the one slick element is the editing. And it lends to the kinetic energy in moments. Mm-hmm. And Romero, before being a filmmaker that we think of him as, he was making commercials in Pittsburgh. And so he had his production company, Latent Image Productions. And so they were accustomed to the whole process of filmmaking. And I think even on the commentary, they talk about how we were filmmakers just making a low budget film. And that kind of – that is through and through the movie, and the idea that they are – for as little money as they had and as little production value as certain elements have, this was an assembly by professionals.
Right. I think the editing is one thing. It you don't see fade outs really. You're not seeing this it just – literally the action starts and stops. And I would say though – in the 1991, when we start talking about that, that's where Savini, I still like the 1991, but I would say if there's a failure, it's in the action in between scenes is just dead and over. It's, you know how a comic book you read between the
panels and you kind of fill in the blanks.
Right, and you can do that with the Romero, but not really in the 1990, I would say. I think it kind of becomes very static in parts.
So the movie starts out in the infamous cemetery scene, and one of the strongest first impressions is the music. And for some reason, I was always under the impression that it was public domain stock music.
Mm-hmm.
And while it was stock music, they did pay for it. It was from the Capitol High Q Library. And they paid like $1,500 for access to all this music. So they put it to good use.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Going back to the idea of like them being polished professionals, they edited the stock music so well to the film that it feels like original score.
It does feel like scored, even though you know, I mean, you know, we're watching it from a different way, though. Let's say we were just like regular person watching it for the first time. You would think it would score.
Yeah, I felt that way. And, it, you know, because it was, you know, in their mind, they were making a B movie for the drive-ins.
Mm-hmm.
And it is that through and through. But it does kind of have these magic elements that gel together. And the music kind of works because they make it work.
Mm-hmm.
I guess before they even get out of the car, we hear the radio come on. And, you know, there's some comment that, like, it was working the whole time. It just wasn't broadcasting until that point. I think we get a little bit of a news clip about a satellite returning back from Venus that had to be exploded or something like that. It's vague, but it's the first little bit of like outside media affecting the story.
Mm-hmm.
And this time around watching it, I've really felt the like War of the Worlds dynamic,
mm-hmm.
where we are sort of stuck in this location while, you know, these characters are dealing with hell on Earth. But the world around them is actually crumbling as well.
Right. It's just that they've been in the car now for, it's like how many hundreds of miles
hours,
he was bitching about. So, you know, they don't know any different.
I did enjoy the brother. And it's funny, like Barbara is kind of humorless and nervous.
Totally.
She's
she
very
sucks.
Tense. From
oh, she's the worst.
And the brother kind of, you know, he's grown up with her, so he kind of, he likes to pick on her.
He's
he
an
likes
asshole
to,
too.
Yeah, and he's telling some story about them fucking around on the cemetery when they were kids and how the grandfather would get really mad. He does a really funny, like, Jewish grandfather impression, which is essentially what Eddie Murphy was doing in Coming to America.
It was from right over there. I jumped out at you from behind the tree, and Grandpa got all excited, and he shook his fist at me, and he said, "Boy, you be damned to hell." Remember that? Right over there.
This is beautiful. What is that, velvet?
What do you know from funny, you bastard?
That brings up this thing. So I'm going to blow your mind right now. Get ready.
Okay.
So, because again, you know, I go to the library and I learn too many things and I never learn anything well enough. One thing, I like to learn lots of little things. And
okay.
So this is from a book called Cultural Critique. It's the chapter is Philosophy of the Living Dead by James McFarlane. And he talks about Zizek's idea of the stain of the real.
Okay. I like
real,
that term.
Not meaning like real of film, but like real life.
Okay.
Real. And it's this idea that he uses it, Zizek uses it to talk about Hitchcock. And he talks very in depth about Hitchcock. But using the term here in Night of the Living Dead, this McFarlane guy uses it for the zombie that's walking out in the background that you
in
he's
the
blurry. You don't even really see anything. It's completely out of focus.
Until you showed me the photograph, I didn't notice.
Yeah, he's just this blurry zombie. And the idea of the stain of the real is that it makes sense where it is, the particular item that's just being shown in the screen.
Okay.
It makes sense that a person would be ambling around a cemetery. These two people probably aren't the only people on the face of the earth.
Sure.
So we don't think anything's wrong with it and we just go about it. And we don't acknowledge it. But what's really cool in this scene where he's talking about the grandfather and they're seeing their father's grave. But get ready. So they're talking about the grandfather and then you see the zombie in the background.
Look, there comes one of them now.
And then they're talking about how the grandfather, Johnny is still like affected by what the grandfather said. It still clearly pisses him off.
Yeah.
And that's the idea of everlasting life, let's say, or like being dead but still being alive
in memory. Yeah.
Exactly. And then this father is the grave who Johnny says, I don't remember what he looks like. And you don't know anything about the father. You only know about this grandfather. And in between, literally, in between them is this zombie. So in between life or like constant living, which is this memory, and the dead grave is like zombie, undead, right in the middle.
Wow.
Literally right in the middle.
I think if you were to break that down to Romero, he'd go, wow, that's fascinating.
Did I do that? But it's so freaking cool because what it does is constantly keep this guy in the frame, this zombie guy. And when we're thinking of these things, when we're thinking of the grandfather, when we're thinking of the father. And then literally when you see it shift to Judith O'Day, you can still see the zombie in the background, and Johnny's complaining or being an asshole to her. Then she gets chased out of the scene by Johnny. Johnny's there again with the guy still in the background. So whether we're thinking about the guy or not,
he's present.
He is there, and that's the idea of the stain of the reel, because it literally stains the scene with its presence. Until then, we get closer and closer, and the way that it's filmed, you never know the distance between them. Between the zombie guy and Judith O'Day and Johnny,
right.
Until it's too close, and then literally you have the camera shot right over the shoulder.
Yeah,
and that's the first time you go, "Oh shit, it's right there."
Yeah, in the remake they use it as a misdirect,
mm-hmm.
where I guess the sort of joke is that everybody who's seen the remake has seen the original,
right?
And you know that dude in the cemetery is gonna pounce. But that guy doesn't. He's just like he's like a wounded,
yeah.
you know, nutter. And it's a guy completely off screen, which is almost a cheat. I mean, I appreciate the sort of
I think it's a
Jurassic
funny joke
Park Raptors kind of thing. I guess it is.
You know, I think it's for the fans, and I think it was just like, oh, it tricked you. And you're like, Savini, you got me. You know, this was one of those where I made a note, and I said that the graveyard zombie, he kind of looks like an old man that maybe had a stroke. And so instead of Barbara being a bitch and running away and screaming and shit, she should probably help him out.
Yeah, she doesn't even consider that.
He doesn't look that weird. Like, he's not made up crazy.
But he's feisty. I mean, it's funny.
Yes, because he had a stroke and he needs help and he can't explain that.
Well, okay, but not actually. Like, he's not actually. He's the undead in this case.
She really doesn't know that, and your mind wouldn't naturally be like...
No, but she's already a very nervous person. I could easily see someone sort of, like, screaming and running away and not even asking any questions. And then I thought, it's a shame that Johnny had to go as early as he did, because I liked him. I thought he was a smartass.
He's not like as bad as Barbara. Vince Vaughn in that one movie where I hate Vince Vaughn so much. That's what he's like.
You couldn't even pick it out. It's Vince Vaughn in every movie.
I can't think of the movie. Shut up, Darren.
But yeah, Barbara is high strung. She's nervous. She's panicky.
Mm-hmm.
And this, like, it's funny. I think of this movie in modern zombie terms, like even the other Romero movies that we've seen. So this guy must be like spry undead. Like he's just fresh, because he's got some speed to him.
Mm-hmm.
And when he pounces on Johnny and his head goes off the tombstone, like that's the ball. But he's not satisfied. You know what? He doesn't commence with the eating. So it is kind of it's an early sign that, like, well, we'll talk about it, that the original idea of zombies came much later, after this movie came out,
right.
And Romero was reading about his own film.
There was an article in Cahiers du Cinéma that called them zombies for the first time. I was clinging to the idea that we had created something new. And when I read that article, I said, oh, this ain't new at all. So that's when I started to accept them as zombies.
Right.
And from then on, he was kind of working with that. But, although the term zombie never comes up in the films.
Right. And zombie, I mean, that's... Yeah, you're not saying it. They're calling it ghouls. But to discount, I think, Romero's impact is a little short-sighted, because what he did, though, was take this idea of this two-dimensional undead creature, marry it with an apocalyptic situation, and then he creates this whole new genre. But before, kind of when you had zombies, let's say, you would feel sorry for them.
Okay, you're talking about like the Bela Lugosi,
yeah,
white zombie,
yeah,
style,
absolutely,
voodoo curse.
And you always
feel
bad for those
guys. They could always come
guys.
Out of it, like they were people,
right.
They were just in trance. And there's some really creepy science about like drugs that could be blown into people's
crazy.
Faces that makes them really
if
malleable.
If we ever do some
people.
Serpent in the Rainbow shit, then we'll look into that.
Oh, that'll be cool.
Yeah, but that's in that one, you know, Bela's the bad guy.
Right,
because
he's the ringleader.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And this was the first time then we see these undead creatures and we don't say, I feel sad a little bit for you.
Yeah, I guess it is. A lot of metaphors work with the zombie dynamic. But in this case, yeah, the sort of very familiar, it actually comes up a couple times once we arrive at the house, but the idea that they start recognizing the neighbors, and that's kind of the other side of that coin with the zombie dynamic, that like you know, Shaun of the Dead did it really well, that when you have empathy and a relationship, frankly, like you're not thinking of these people as dead because they're moving around. They're,
right.
you know, they're coming after you. And so killing them is, you know, next to impossible. You're not thinking of them as dead people. They're, you know, just a little slower, a little dopier.
Aw, that's sad when you put it that way. Actually, I have a quote from Simon Pegg talking about zombies and mm-hmm. stuff, and it's kind of interesting. He says, a zombie has a specific, like, function that it is in a story. And it says, Simon Pegg says, metaphorically, this classic creature embodies a number of our greatest fears. Most obviously, it's our own death personified, the physical manifestation of that which we fear most. More subtly, the zombie represents a number of our deeper insecurities, the fear that deep down, we may be a little more than animals, concerned only with our appetite. And it's interesting, you start recognizing the neighbors or things like that, and it puts now this whole spin, because if it's people you know, it could be you, kind of this idea.
Yeah, yeah. Present day, looking back at this, we have like a set of rules in mind for like what zombies do and what
right.
zombies don't do. And Simon Pegg's actually a very vocal proponent of like zombies are slow.
Right, right.
If they're fast, they're not zombies.
He has very specific zombie rules.
You know, there's an argument that Bill Hinden, who played the very first zombie in Night of the Living Dead, you know, he's pretty sprightly as a zombie. He was kind of, he wasn't moving particularly slowly. You know, the beginning of zombie evolution started with quite a quick-footed zombie. To be honest,
when we were making Night of the Living Dead, we had no sense of rules. It wasn't until I finally agreed to do another one that I said, well, wait, we got to have a little process going here. We have to have something. I know that Bill moves pretty quickly, so I think I sort of violated my own rules there, but I didn't even have rules then.
Before there was the framework, Romero was just, you know, he was still referring to them as ghouls. They were
right.
flesh-eating. They were cannibalistic. So he didn't think twice to have the cemetery guy pick up a rock and try and smash a window. Like,
right.
he was, you know, not dissimilar to, like, an ape using tools
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
These zombies don't seem to follow a lot of rules. Like, if I wanted to be picky, let's say it has kind of the congruency of like the X-Files universe, in which it just doesn't. Because some of them can make noises, some of them can't make any noises, some of them eat people, but some of them don't seem to be hungry.
No.
Some of them use tools.
A couple of them, yeah.
One in particular literally rips off someone's necklace before biting them. I don't think
clearing
zombies,
a path.
They don't
going
care.
For the throat.
They don't care. That's absurd.
Later in the remake, Tom Savini talked about trying to direct people as zombies and trying to give them, like, body reference for mm-hmm. how they would move.
But it backfired on us because it looked funny. People were, you know, just doing incredibly wild things. And it wound up just move slow. And it was the same thing, I think, that George said to zombies in the original film.
So when Barbara arrives to the house, This is sort of the crux of the story is going to take place in this home.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a house sort of donated to the production by a farmer. It was going to be torn down so they could really just destroy it if need be, except it was empty.
Yeah.
And so on one of the commentaries, they talk about having to furnish a house to destroy. They rolled up to the Goodwill. They talked to the manager. For $50, they got full access to a back room full of furniture, and they just loaded up a flatbed truck with everything they could carry.
Nice.
And it's funny because it's in black and white. There's no moment of like, well, that's a weird non-matching color
furniture.
Yeah,
I don't even think about the furniture. Everything seems to go and match and everything like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's uniform, I mean, because it is real. It's literally like, you know, two colors.
Yeah.
So once Barbara's in the house, enter Dwayne L. Jones, playing Ben, a graduate of the Sorbonne in France.
Yes.
He studied acting in New York City as well. He was teaching in New York and had to travel to Pittsburgh for the movie, which is to say, like, he earned his role in this movie. Everybody
Absolutely.
Else is kind of like a friend of a friend. There
mm-hmm.
were a number of, like, receptionists who were cast.
Yeah.
But he was just the best actor who auditioned for that role. And I love that. I mean, there's no getting around it. The movie is a classic because Dwayne L. Jones factors into the story
mm-hmm.
in so many different ways. The movie was made in 1967. The role is, you know, he is not like a knight in shining armor. He is not like a spotless hero.
No.
Barbara is acting hysterical, and this is 1967, so their idea of like triage psychology was a good smack across the face.
It's true. It's true. And she, I would have smacked her too. I absolutely would have.
Don't you know what's going on out there? This is no Sunday school picnic.
Don't you understand? My brother is alone.
Your brother is dead.
No! My brother is not dead!
I mean, he even at one point shoots somebody for not agreeing with his plans.
He was getting in the way.
He was getting in the way, obstacle. But we can't just, you know.
Yeah, no, society devolved pretty quickly in that house. But it's not, you know, it wasn't unprovoked. He was.
Oh, no, it wasn't. They were just like going out shooting people. But I am saying, like, that's not your typical hero kind of guy.
Not at all.
You don't, if, like, the first part of, like, dissension, just, like, shoot.
Yeah,
that's not, that's fascism at its best. In that house, that's what's going on.
I think
of him
as an anti-hero, but I guess it's fascism all the same.
I don't want to hear any more from you, mister. If you stay up here, you take orders from me, and that includes leaving the girl alone.
Tragically, Jones died of a heart attack when he was only 51 years old, so he wasn't involved in any more Romero projects. He did continue to teach in New York, and he was a big figure in black theater, but he admitted he had never even watched any of Romero's other films. Like,
it's probably okay.
He was a little more of an academic. Like, he took the craft very seriously.
Right.
And people on set describe him as very serious. He was very friendly. He was very kind. But he kept to himself. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't making huge efforts to ingratiate himself with the cast. But yeah, I don't know. I love it. He's by far the best actor in the film.
Of course he is. Of course he is. Which, and again, we'll talk about in the 1990 version, is a very different cast, because the 1990 version is a cast of legitimate stage actors.
Yeah.
And so it's just interesting how each director kind of is able to use his actors. And I think it says a lot about Ben Dwayne Jones that he was able to bring the other people up to his level.
Jones has been in those first few kills on screen. I thought that I don't know if I noticed this in earlier viewings, but he's like visibly sickened by the by the violence that he's capable of. And it's a weird pull, but like I grew up loving kung fu movies, and Bruce Lee had a very like almost standard reaction to death. And he would sort of do like the, you know, frozen eye freak out. And Ben almost goes there. And I thought it was actually a little bit of a nod to that. Tony Todd in the remake crosses himself after killing those first few. And it, you know, it's kind of an acknowledgement that, like, you know, there but for the grace of God go I.
Yeah, I mean, it's an entryway into nihilism. A zombie film is that way because, and you know, then that's the whole allegory all the time is who's really the bad guy and who's the monster, which is hammered into your head in the 1990 film. But it is that entry into just not giving a fuck anymore.
This station and hundreds of other radio and TV stations throughout this part of the country are pooling their resources through an emergency network hookup to keep you informed of all developments. At this hour, we repeat.
Once they're in the house, they get the radio to work. Mm-hmm. They eventually find the television upstairs. On the television, the reporter is Chili Billy Cardeal, who was a television reporter. He was like Elvira before Elvira. He was one of those kind of late night television hosts. I thought it was funny to read that he would occasionally sit in on the Channel 11 news. And I love the idea of a guy like sort of pulling his cape off and pulling his teeth out to report on the local fair. but he also makes a cameo in the remake as well.
Yeah.
So once they're in the house, there's already been a bunch of commotion. A couple of zombies have been taken down. And that's when finally Carl Hardman playing Harry pops out. And, you know, sort of reveals that there's a whole host of people in the basement.
Exactly.
And they've just been listening to this commotion. Barbara screaming like a maniac.
Yeah,
like,
even if, let's say they were behind the door, they would have heard Ben yelling at Barbara and slapping her, too. And they just like, whatever.
Not our problem.
But Ben is gone. He leaves Barbara in one of the worst plans ever. Never. Firstly, Barbara needs a leash on her. She's like Carl. She's just like going to wander off. So he goes upstairs to investigate this dead body that Barbara has already found. But did you notice that that body is, like, really dead? It's been dead for a long time. Like, the whole face is decomposed. Not torn off, but decomposed. And I was thinking,
well,
like,
it might
maybe...
it might have been chewed on.
I think it looks like... well, it's not a good... it's not a good appliance. It's not a good...
yeah. I mean, it had, like, ping pong balls cut in half for eyeballs. Yeah. That was a Romero special. Yeah.
It's
that
a
pretty
bad one. And so then I was thinking, like, is there some mystery behind, like, what happened in this house? Did these people never even be affected by the zombies? And I might like to know a prequel mystery. Murder mystery.
If memory serves, Romero's son was trying to put some money together to do a prequel. To do the sort of
story
leading
up to this. But see, I think there was like some other murder that had happened in that house, and then she wandered into
Zombie apocalypse is a perfect time to try and get away with murder.
It's actually true. But anyway, he goes upstairs, leaves Barbara, and that's when, yeah.
Yeah, so Carl Hardman, Harry Cooper, he's another guy who's pulling like double and triple duty. He served as makeup artist, electronic sound effects engineer, and he took the still photos used for the closing credits. Incidentally, like, him and Jones got along really well. Like, they were good friends by the end of the shooting of the movie. And I kind of love that like, these guys who are at odds the entire length of the film.
Because you hate Cooper so much. Oh, my God, I hate that guy.
You know, we talk about Dwayne Jones being a great actor. But in all fairness, Carl Hardman, great actor himself.
Yeah,
because
he is.
You hate him.
Yes, you really, really do.
On the commentary, he jokes that, like, when he sort of enters the movie, he jokes, what would have happened if everybody just followed me into the basement? And I was thinking, everybody would have lived. Is what would have happened.
I know, that's the best part. It's like Ben is yelling at him the whole time, and then you find out, like, that was kind of the best fucking idea anyone ever had.
Yeah, it's
bad job, Ben. Bad.
The story is kind of almost an experiment in, like, extreme reactions and the idea that, you know, you're not always thinking long term.
Mm-hmm.
They, you know, they were nervous to try and chance it the 5 miles down the road to the nearest town or whatever, or I don't remember if it was a military base. But the sort of scaredy cat response of going into the cellar would have saved them off. They turned off all the lights,
mm-hmm.
made the house not a beacon of activity.
Right.
They probably would have made it to the morning when the sort of, you know, riot crew came through with
Absolutely.
Their guns firing. Yeah, but it's just because Harry is such an antagonistic asshole.
Such made. That's the Vince Vaughn movie. Sorry. Anyway, yes.
That's
he is such an asshole. And so, like, the whole time you're just like, fuck you. Whatever you say. Like, even if he was saying the best thing in the world, which clearly, actually, he was, you're just like, I don't want to listen to this shit.
How long have you guys been down there? I could use some help up here.
That's the cellar. It's the safest place.
You mean you didn't hear the racket we were making up here?
How are we supposed to know what was going on? Could have been those things for all we knew.
That girl was screaming. Sure, you must know what a girl screaming sounds like. Those things don't make any noise. Anybody would know somebody ever needed help.
Look, it's kind of hard to hear what's going on from down there.
We thought we could hear screams, but for all we knew, that could have meant those things were in the house afterward.
And you wouldn't come up and help.
Well, if there were more...
the racket sounded like the place was being ripped apart. How were we supposed to know what was going on?
Now, wait a minute. You just got finished saying you couldn't hear from down there. Now you say it sounded like the place was being ripped apart. It would be nice if you get your story straight, man.
All right, now you tell me. I'm not going to take that kind of a chance when we got a safe place. We luck into a safe place, and you're telling us we got to risk our lives just because somebody might need help, huh?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, I was thinking there's got to be a chapter in, like, Dale Carnegie material in terms of influencing people that, like, as good as your ideas are, no one's going to follow you if you're a fucking dickhead.
It is. Dale Carnegie, you know how I love Dale Carnegie. I love that, manipulating people. I use it for evil, but Dale Carnegie actually has a story about leading a cow into the barn. And if you push on a cow, it'll, like, dig in and sit. And you can't move the thing because they weigh a lot. But if you lead it with an ear of corn, it'll walk right into the barn with you.
Huh. All right. That makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you go.
And in this case, Carl Hardman has his wife and daughter in the basement, as well as Tom and Judy.
Mm-hmm.
And so you never really get the feeling that he is doing this for the sake of the group. Like, he is purely a selfish asshole. But he is, in fact, like, saving people by keeping them in the basement.
Right.
And then when they start arguing that, everybody else kind of doesn't want to be with the asshole, so they want to move upstairs.
Which, well, you know what? They wouldn't have been okay. They wouldn't have been okay.
Because of the daughter?
Mm-hmm.
They could overpower the daughter, but it certainly would have been a conflict between Harry and Ben. But yeah, so the daughter, they explain, has been bitten. Mm-hmm. And it's funny that, like, you know, as a modern horror fan,
we know that's no good.
The moment you hear bitten by one of those crazies, you know that it's not going to end well.
What's wrong with her? How'd she get hurt?
One of those things grabbed her.
Bit her on the arm.
What's wrong?
Who knows what kind of disease those things carry? Is she conscious?
Barely.
She can't walk. She's too weak.
Up to this point, they just, you know, recognize that her head is hot. She's got a fever. But otherwise, like, they were just ready to camp out there for the night. Everybody else comes upstairs. It's funny, even Harry's wife doesn't like him. Like,
no, she doesn't. She really doesn't. I love her, actually. I think she's like a great, like, you know.
She's a good foil for Harry.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's not anybody in the film on his side.
Which is probably partly why he's such a dick.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, he even, at some point, he sort of admits defeat and just kind of bunkers them in there with Ben on the outside.
Let them stay upstairs. Let them. Too many ways those monsters can get in up there. We'll see who's right. We'll see when they come begging me to let them in down here.
That's important, isn't it?
What?
To be right, everybody else to be wrong.
What do you mean by that?
Does anyone up there know why we're being attacked?
Whatever it is, it isn't just happening here. It's some kind of mass murder. It's going on everywhere. The radio said to stay inside.
Radio?
Radio upstairs. I heard a news bulletin.
There's a radio upstairs and you boarded us in down here?
I know what I'm doing.
What did it say?
Nothing. Nothing. They don't know anything yet. There's mass murder everywhere and people are supposed to look for a safe place to hide.
Take the boards off that door.
We are staying down here, Helen.
Harry, that radio is at least some kind of communication. If the authorities know what's happening, well, they'll send people for us or they'll tell us what to do. How are we going to know what's going on if we lock ourselves in this dungeon?
And there's another point, though, where Ben is kind of not being a hero. That's not hero behavior when he forces himself into the bunker to get a door.
Yeah,
and he
they
considers
find out there's lumber
literally
downstairs.
So they're needing all these doors so they can block up the windows. And the daughter is actually staying on a door that's being repainted. She's laying on the door that's being like repainted on some horses. And Ben like literally looks at that door for too long. And even the dad realizes, you're going to take that door from out underneath my daughter? Are you kidding right now? And it does cross Ben's mind.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
Need all the doors.
It's funny, the woman who plays the daughter is on one of the commentaries for the DVD, which I guess they originally did for the Laserdisc that sort of dates it. But but it's kind of fun that there were elements that she liked, there were elements that she didn't like. She did not like watching her father wounded, but she had no qualms.
Because that's her real
attacking.
Father.
I think so. It sounded
Cooper
that way.
Cooper is her real dad.
Okay. Yeah. Fascinating. Okay. That makes more sense. The attacks on the dad, she thought, were fun. Everything else was good times. Thinking of the movie now as a classic and the idea, Night of the Living Dead, it's a cinematic name.
Yes.
Like, it's a short story for a name. it came so late in the process that they were, you know, during production, they referred to it as simply, quote unquote, monster flick.
And fair enough.
And at one point, it was Night of the Flesh Eaters.
Terrible idea.
And I guess it was much further down the line when they were sort of figuring out the marketing that they decided on Night of the Living Dead. Originally, the beings attacking the characters were extraterrestrial, like the original script idea. They were extraterrestrial in origin, either aliens or humans possessed by an alien pathogen, presumably covering a NASA satellite returning from Venus. Eventually, it was decided that the dead would rise and devour the living, presumably due to radiation that was caused by a NASA satellite returning from Venus. But the big taboo was that they were consuming human flesh. This was a story of cannibalistic sort of undead.
And this is that again, this is my trip to the library, and I started reading a lot about Freud's idea of uncanny, of the uncanny, and how it relates to horror. And tons of people have been writing about it. And one of the things that makes something uncanny is something familiar doing something not familiar, like people eating people.
Yeah, a person acting like an animal.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of the top taboos, yeah, they're eating each other, but in one of the scenes towards the end, spoiler, if you don't use the fast forward button if you don't want to hear the next following things. But originally, Mr. Cooper was going to be dead from the gunshot wound.
Right, right.
He was going to be a zombie. He was going to go down and attack the daughter. And then Romero said, it'll be cooler if we do it this way. He stumbles downstairs now, Mr. Cooper, and the daughter eats him. So what you're really having is total taboo. You're having now this daughter eating the person who gave her life. So this dead being eating the thing that gave her life.
Yeah, this cannibalistic patricide.
And that's that idea of this, of what Freud calls the uncanny, which is this just unsettling thing. It's one of these things. And it would have been equally as effective. It would have been gross if he would have eaten the daughter or something like that. But to have the daughter eat him is like, now you've got layers and layers of shit.
And it serves to the mindset of actually the mom who precedes that scene, that her daughter is back on her feet, but she's not her daughter anymore.
Right.
But the mother is clearly so traumatized by that idea that, you know, my sweetie is coming at me with a garden
trowel.
And Helen is another one of the great actors, and we talked about how she's like an equal sort of foil for Harry.
We may not enjoy living together, but dying together isn't going to solve anything. Those people aren't our enemies.
That she goes from like this strong figure to seeing her daughter in this mode that she never would have anticipated. She's kind of like paralyzed in fear and just becomes this like standing still target.
Right.
The way this movie plays, and even by the admission of the filmmakers, it was supposed to be a drive-in style B movie, and it was, but it's one of those rare instances. I really believe it is so much greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if any of the elements were changed out, it would not be the classic that we think of. If they stuck with the original idea for Ben in the script, where he was supposed to be just like a tough,
very angry. He was supposed to be an angry
driver.
Guy.
Yeah. Or even if there was studio money or pressure from any producer about the content, or even if it had come out a year earlier or a year later, I think it would chip away at the inherent magic that makes the movie work.
I could see that.
I thought it was funny that Reader's Digest tried to warn people away from watching the film in 1968, claiming that if it's ever watched, it will inspire cannibalism.
Yeah, you know, I do get hungry because seeing people eat ham and covered in chocolate really makes me hungry.
Just the description of what those actors were having to do was gross.
Like, oh, here's this fucking cold cut with some chocolate on it. Thanks.
But I love that the Reader's Digest, which, like, you know, all our grandparents kind of had it in the bathroom. It's such a ridiculous thing to suggest.
Well, you know, they were always suggesting like crazy shit. If you watch Beavis and Butthead, you'll set someone on fire or some shit.
Or firecrackers in the ass of frogs, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Reader's Digest. So this is kind of a sadder note, but at the time of the film's release, any work that did not include a copyright notice was assumed to be public domain. Mm-hmm. And since the filmmakers forgot to include this, the film slipped into public domain. It was not until March 1st, 1989, that a copyright notice was no longer required. As a result, George Romero saw very little profit from the film, and the distributors walked away with practically all of the profits. That's part of the reason Romero wanted to make a new version of his film, is to sort of, you know, sort of take back the night and frankly get back some of that money. And so that will bring us to 1990, Night of the Living Dead by Tom Savini.
When I was in high school, George came to my high school to audition people for a movie called Wine of the Fawn, which never got made. I approached him about doing the makeup for his Night of the Living Dead. He was so busy, I was following him around the studio, flipping pages of my portfolio. He says, yeah, man, we could use you. Unfortunately, they called me to go in the Army right before George shot Night of the Living Dead. So when he did that, I was in Vietnam. I remember him coming to me and saying, we're going to remake Night of the Living Dead. And I'm thinking, oh, great. Finally, I get to do the effects in George's remake of Night of the Living Dead. He says, and I want you to direct it.
George felt, and he had enough confidence in Tom Savini to let that be his feature film directorial debut.
Sometimes when we were on the set of my Night of the Living Dead, I would just think to myself, look where you are. You know, you didn't get to do the original film, and you're here directing the remake, so it made it easier.
Movies are my life. My life is movies.
But as it turns out, Savini actually went to school for that. Here's a little bit of Savini history and trivia. Tom Savini attended Point Park University for 3 years before enlisting in the United States Army, where he served as a combat photographer during the Vietnam War. So he talks about this in terms of like being a frequent reference point for like
right.
where he talks about the gore and the sort of savagery of war and right. you know what like bullet impacts would
really
actually look
like.
Things like that. After his tour, he attended Carnegie Mellon University as the first undergraduate to be awarded a full fellowship in the acting and directing program. He appeared on stage in productions throughout college and continued on stage long after his tour of duty in Vietnam. And he's been a stuntman.
Mm-hmm.
He's great in From Dusk Till Dawn.
I think he's one of those guys who it would like make a great director just because he would never ask, I think, anyone to do something he wouldn't do. Because he's done the
stunts.
That's
a really good
point.
He's
done the acting. He's done the wearing the makeup. He's done the makeup. Like,
yeah, Tom Savini deserves his own episode. And I'd love to get around to doing a sort of like history retrospective kind of thing.
Primarily, I'm known for doing special makeup effects in lots of horror movies. In fact, you could call me, they have called me, the king of splatter. You know, I was involved in the heyday of the splatter films with Dawn of the Dead, Friday the 13th, I've done two of those, the sequel Day of the Dead. They all started for me when I saw the movie Man of a Thousand Faces. In fact, I wanted to be Lon Chaney. When I saw that movie, I went home and I tried to create on my own face the Phantom, the Hunchback, things that I saw him create. My goal was always to like be an actor in films, and I thought that what would get me in the door would be the special makeup effects. So I try to play a part in the films that I do effects on. I've done stunts, acting, I've directed now, I'm a tournament fencer. If you've seen Dusk Till Dawn, it was my idea to use the bullwhip because I'm pretty good with the bullwhip. So the more I've done, the more I've gotten to do.
All right, and this one, I think we're treated. It's such a treat to see Bill Moseley, which, like, he's wearing glasses and he's in disguise.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, it's 1990, it's a few, you know, years ago, but, like, to see him is always a great, like,
Chop Top.
Yeah.
Texas Chainsaw
Massacre.
He's
always great to see. So, Bill Moseley starts off and he's Johnny this time. Equally as annoying, maybe more annoying than.
I liked it. It's funny you think of them both as annoying. I thought that, I don't know, I guess I relate to, like, the sort of annoying brother. Kind of
I think
poking,
maybe
poking
I hate
and teasing.
You in real life. I don't know. Then Barbara, she's played by Patricia Tallman, who, and again, this is what I was talking about before. This time we have a lot of real theater actors in this particular show. Then Tony Todd is Ben, and Tony Todd, awesome actor.
Yeah.
I love seeing him.
And this was before Candyman. So he had been in Platoon, and that was a pretty big role. But Candyman is kind of where everybody knows him from, and he's this great imposing figure. He's a very tall guy.
Yeah,
he actually resembles Dwayne Jones quite a bit, and they talk about that in the casting process.
I wanted the characters in Night of the Living Dead 90 to physically be very similar to the characters in the original.
I did want to go back to Patricia Tallman, Patty, as Tom Savini refers to her a number of times on the commentary. She's a stunt woman. She's a stage actress. She's been in a bunch of stuff, including Babylon 5 and some Star Trek: The Next Generation.
That's where I had seen her from, I think. Like, and that's where I recognizes.
I guess I hadn't. I think this was the first time I sort of recognized her. She's very attractive. And short haired redhead.
Yeah, this very single white female.
Yeah,
I was like, wow. Did everyone look like this in 1990?
Yeah.
Maybe. I don't know.
And so, her take as Barbara is a far greater arc this time around. And I guess it's debatable, but it sounds like one of the original designs for the 68 Night of the Living Dead was to have Barbara be a little bit more of a, you know, a strong female lead.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, they went the sort of demure, in shock the whole time character.
Yeah, yeah, that idea.
But here, Tallman is so much better of a character.
You're led to believe, I think, in the beginning that she's going to be the same old Barbara.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Tony Todd is like, hey, and she's not really responsive or anything. But she's actually the first one, which finally, after all these years, she's like one of the first people to say,
they're so slow. We could just walk right past them. We wouldn't even have to run. We could just walk right past them. We have the guns. If we're careful, we could get away. You told me to fight. Well, I'm fighting. I'm not panicking. This place is not safe, not upstairs or down. We should leave before it's too late.
I really did like that.
Why does no one see this?
In the original, you're faced with the options of you can bunker down in the basement or you can stay upstairs and barricade the windows and doors. No one makes the obvious estimation that, like, we could just leave and not
even
let
them
gang
up
on us.
I can get back up and keep on walking. I don't even need to run. I can walk.
You could power walk. Yeah.
I'm very fast.
That's all it would take.
Very fast. Yeah, so it's good to see her in there. This time, Harry Cooper, I don't know if he's more of an asshole or equally as asshole-ish, because I love the first Harry Cooper, but this time we have Tom Talls.
He's a little angrier, and I thought they played it's only touched on, but this guy plays up the racist element a little more than the original Harry.
You kind of assume the first Harry Cooper. I don't know. Maybe he just hates everybody, but I kind of assumed he was like a racist asshole.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, but he's sort of foiled by his wife again.
And right, and this time like Helen is McKee Anderson, and I love this new kind of they clearly hate each other, these two, and in both movies they hate each other.
And I love that it really is a slice of life element where they were on their way to somewhere fancy because he's in a tux when shit goes down, and Tommy lets him into the house, and that's the whole thing. But like, the end of the world, zombie apocalypse was not on the agenda for this evening.
Exactly. But I love how, and this one was one where I think the 68 really stopped short of it, and Tom Savini read into it a little bit further and gave you this. And that's why I referred to this as fanfic, because we're getting a little more backstory. Mm. These two actually, at one point, turn into physical violence between the two of them, which is so implied in the 68 version, but this time we're actually seeing the violence against both of them against each other.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was kind of a neat take on it, because we were all kind of assuming that was there, and this is more blatant in 1990.
What do you hope to accomplish?
Shut up, Helen!
I'm counting to three, Cooper. Then I'm coming through.
We're going to open!
On the commentary, Tom Savini talks about casting Tony Todd, and it harkens back to the casting of Dwayne Jones in terms of he was just the best guy who showed up to audition.
But they were, I think, looking for an African-American actor this time, for sure.
They were keeping to those roles. However, Tony Todd, he won out over Lawrence Fishburne, Ving Rhames, Eric LaSalle.
All these guys were considered for the role. I can't imagine ever passing up Ving Rhames for him.
Yeah, this would have been interesting.
I just think he's like one of the best actors that you never think highly of. But he really is good.
He is, yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But and this was before, this would have been the first major role that we would have seen him in.
Mm-hmm.
But all the same, you gotta love Tony Todd. We start out on the same parallel track as the first one. And it's funny, we talked about the term?
Stain of the Real?
The Stain of the Real.
Mm-hmm.
And how in the original cemetery shots, we see the first zombie off in the background, and he's off in between them. But he's just consistently in the shot, but we don't second guess it because people go to cemeteries to pay their respects. Tom Savini plays the old switcheroo, and there's a number of times where that guy is over their shoulder in the background.
And we as audience people, we know that we're like, zombie guy right there. But switcheroo.
Yeah, and so when that guy comes into frame, it turns out that guy wasn't even an actor. He was just a friend of Tom Savini who had a gaunt look to him. So he was like, you look like a zombie, you want to be in this? And he's good.
Yeah.
That dude is like... in pure shock. You thought he might have had a stroke before he entered the scene.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's what made me go back to the 68 and think, like, maybe Barbara in 68 shouldn't have been such a bitch because that man clearly needs help. And it was the 1990 version that made me say, like, oh, I should reconsider this.
Yeah, it's funny. Johnny essentially asked that. He goes, are you okay? Can we do anything for
right.
you? And that's when the guy pounces from off frame.
Which is impossible because we know how slow that they move. We know that he couldn't have snuck up on Johnny, but whatever.
This was a motivated zombie. But so once Barbara has her freak out, well, we do see Johnny take a hard blow against a tombstone on the ground and kind of, I guess the assumption is that it snaps his neck, crushes his head.
I don't know. He bonks his noggin and it kills him.
It's not a great dummy that hits that tombstone. I think the shot picks up a little too soon. If you were to just see the impact, you might get away with it a little more. But
yeah.
I don't want to nitpick the effects.
Exactly.
Because the effects are actually really good.
You know, the thing is this 1990 film, I love it. And sometimes I think, I love it because I love the 68 one so much. Because there are certain things that I can just pick apart, but I don't care. And I sit there and I watch it and I go, this is great. This is the best thing ever.
Cohesive.
But there's big problems and certain things. And that idea of the stain of the real or the idea of Freud's uncanny is really, I don't think it's something that the director like Romero, I don't think he sat down and thought, I'm going to do this and this is this and this represents this. But it works because it does represent, you know what I'm saying? He fell into it. And the reason we as the audience respond to it is because it is saying these things to us, whether he meant to do it or not. I think there's a few times that Savini just doesn't go for those opportunities, and so it doesn't work in the same way.
I will say there are a couple Easter eggs, and there are a couple moments that show that Tom Savini was actually putting a lot of thought, even in things that don't really get full exposure. But, you know, I'm not going to fully spoil it, but when the viewer watches it, and you should see these a second and third time, entering the house, the name of the house is significant.
Mm-hmm.
It's named after, like, essentially a ghost ship.
Right.
And so the idea that Barbara comes into the house and no one's around, the stove, the oven is going, she's, like, trying to figure out where everyone went. It's like a ghost house. So there are elements like that that play through. And, yeah, I don't know. I think Tom Savini, he certainly storyboarded the hell out of the movie, and he talks about that a lot on the director's commentary. So it allowed for them to make like the most streamlined, efficient movie is because they had a constant reference for what they wanted. So it was all plotted out, and every, you know, there are tons of bonus moments in terms of special effects and stuff like that. But in terms of like the structure of the movie, I was really impressed. And it's a bummer that Tom Savini doesn't commit to directing more.
Yeah. I mean, he did the short film in
Theater Bazaar?
Yeah, he did that.
Yeah, I like that one. You
didn't
love it so much.
I didn't love that thing. So, I mean, you do see him every now and then. I feel, I don't know, I think he does so much of different talks and circuits that I think he doesn't have a lot of time for other things, maybe.
Yeah, I think it was on an episode of the Room Morgue podcast that was before one of his movie screenings. He was just sort of doing a Q&A. He referred to making this movie as like a lot of work, separate from like a lot of fun.
Sure.
So you kind of got the feeling that like he loves the special effects. He loves the like stunt work and the, you know, his book is called The Grand Illusions. Like he loves the like the sort of modern magic of special effects and getting all those things to work. The comprehensive like taking the helm as a director is taxing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a lot of organization, and you could have the best assistant, and you still are going to be rewriting those shots the same day, I think, you know?
And he didn't credit himself as being one of the special effects guys, but he did he designed a bunch of the special effects. Mm-hmm. But
in the 1990 remake, John Vulich and Everett Burrell did a fantastic job. The technology of special effects makeup was definitely on their side.
I had heard from John as a fan, as a young kid, writing letters to me and showing me his masks.
It's wonderful.
We started working with Tom early on, actually both Everett and I, on Day of the Dead.
One of the things that I've learned is that we don't necessarily just do makeup, we create characters. We create characters that help to tell a story.
They actually used a computer to take a picture of somebody and design zombies on the computer way back then. The key zombies all wore these special lenses, so the eyes were gone. So if you looked in the eyes, nobody there. Erase the eyes, you erase the person. So that's what we tried to do with the zombies in my version, is try to get rid of their eyes and make them soulless.
Once we're at the house, we have Tony Todd enter. Barbara's still hysterical. She's not really using her words yet.
Yeah, well, she also gets hit on the head, hit right on the face with a hand. And I think, I wrote that in my notes. I was like, how awful is it that, already shit's kind of wrong and your brother just died and now someone literally slaps you in the face with a hand. You know, it's the worst thing ever.
Yeah,
but I do love that.
She's got
big
the bloody
zombie
mark on her face and yeah, that guy topples from the roof.
Yeah, I think he's great. And I thought also how would it be to be crushed by a zombie? Those are just the worst ways to die. It's sometimes when I walk through the crosswalk and a smart car almost hits me, I'm like, how embarrassing would it be that I got killed by a smart car? And I think in her situation, it'd be how awful that you get crushed to death by this big zombie, but that also slaps you in the face with someone else's hand.
How great would it have been if Tony Todd rolls up, comes into the house, and she's just flailing under a giant body?
You should hope that Tony Todd, you could die just being crushed under the weight of that.
Yeah. Tough way to go.
I know.
We now get Harry and I guess Tommy are the first two that come out of the basement. They come out in a group this time around.
Tom is an interesting character. I think he does a fine job in this film. And then I started looking into him and he is the man responsible for Ginger Dead Man. And not only did he write Ginger Dead Man, he also wrote he also directed Ginger Dead. God damn, I can never get that right. Ginger Dead Man 2 and 3.
Oh.
He's actually got writing credits then for Ginger Dead Man versus Evil Bong, which I gave to women in caskets as their punishment for losing.
Because it's one of the all-time worst films ever made.
I know. So I was just like, wow, this man is so responsible for so many terrible things. He does a fine job in this.
He looks a little bit like a young John Fogerty, that guy. Yeah. I don't know. That was a weird note I made.
John Fogerty.
I think so. Once Harry and company come out of the basement, mm-hmm. and they waste no time in arguing with each other and what's the best mode of survival. And I think that's the first time that Barbara notices that the zombies are moving so slow they could just weave right through them and escape. And then there's more talk about their chances of getting to town. If they take the cars, if they run out of gas, what then? It's a lot of ifs and buts.
But just walk. Use your feet. Yeah. I don't understand.
Yeah. I think
I can walk for miles.
It only makes sense for Harry and his wife to stay on account of the daughter in the basement being bitten.
That's true. That does make sense.
But it's still, I guess you'd feel really bad. You couldn't really leave them there, go for help. Harry would always want to stay.
That's something that always happens in movies. And I wonder how long, if I was in that situation, I would ponder about it, because eventually you do have to leave to go get help, but maybe you've stayed too long. Do you leave immediately to go get help? I don't, in this world of cell phones now, I don't think about that, but maybe in some situation I might have to.
Yeah.
What do you do?
It's so commonly pushed and pulled in horror movies. You get the idea that bunkering down is going to lead you to this Michael Jackson's Thriller kind of, they're going to crash through the windows at some point. But other movies, when they do take it on the road and say run out of hope, in The Mist, then you're kind of faced with that. So every movie is going to play.
I mean, I'm going to always fight it out. I would like to think of myself that I would stick it out. I don't think I would pull a Mist situation. But
I
leave my loved one if I find my loved one has no leg now because let's say he got captured in Wolf Creek scenario. Now he doesn't have a leg. And do I leave him to go get help? Do you stay?
Do you try and get him to hop along with you?
Right.
Yeah. It's a tough call. I always said that I used to be a bunker guy.
I know you did. I told you about that.
Lock the doors, turn off the lights, just wait it out. I've come around.
Good.
I'm now.
Because remember, I wasn't going to invite you into my zombie brigade because I knew you were going to just be sitting in a hole somewhere.
Yeah, no, I think now I'm more of a seek rural refuge mm-hmm. kind of guy.
I have a plan. Yeah, I know exactly where I'm going.
I think on our zombie episode, I think that was episode 4, we talked about our like disaster preparedness plans.
Yeah.
And I think since then, we both now have like bug out bags.
Right. I mean, we have the bug out bag, but you know, we moved back into Manhattan just a couple months ago, and now we have to completely redo our plan. We had a very specific plan to get to our dog out in Queens, but now we're in Manhattan, so it's a little easier.
Okay. Yeah. I guess hoping that the bridges aren't closed down or bombed like in I Am Legend. Yeah. I don't know. Getting out might be tough.
Yeah. But anyway,
once the incursion starts and the house is surrounded, there are some great zombie kills.
Yes.
The one that jumps out at me is the naked skinny black guy who comes through the window.
Yes.
He is, I mean, he's only shown from the waist up, but that guy was Tom Savini's cab driver from like, you know, whatever train station or whatever to set. And in meeting him, he's just like, you got a great look to you. Would you want to be in the movie? And he's like, yeah, all right, sure. Okay, let's do it. That actually happened twice. There's another guy on the porch who also Tom Savini ran into at like a Pittsburgh diner. It's just like, you want to be in a movie?
And he's like, okay.
All right. They talk about making these in Pittsburgh. Everybody wants to join in on the fun.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny that like New York has its zombie parades and shit like that. Yeah, but like, Pittsburgh is zombie central.
Yeah,
like ever since Romero made the original, people there just are known for it. I'm sure they sell T-shirts in local diners and
right,
shit like
right.
that. But in this case, it was a cab driver who pops through the window. He's seemingly naked. So when Barbara is making the point that they'll only die if you hit him in the head, she shoots him in the body like 2 or 3 times.
Yeah.
And it's a pretty rare special effect. But just like bullets on bare skin.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, you know, if you're a special effects nerd, you know that like there's got to be protection and then a squib and then, you know, the sort of rubber latex over that. So it's a hard effect to pull off realistically, but this is
It looks great. Yeah.
And
those
he finally takes the
great.
Headshot and he falls back. And even the headshot is on camera.
Oh, yeah. And it's a gruesome one. It's very bad. Barbara's a great shot, though, in this.
Yeah. I mean, in all fairness, like, she's suddenly, 5 feet away.
Yeah. But like still, you should see it the way some people shoot. So, you know.
Yeah. But that's the first time that we see her go like full Rambo. She is now like Sigourney Weaver's Ripley. Like she's proactive.
Yeah.
She's not in shock anymore. She's taking a role in this whole thing. I was going to say, so when that guy, the original shot of that guy going down, that headshot was even rigged for the back of his head to like pink mist style explode. But it was one of those things that for the rating, they had to take out a bunch of headshots from the movie. So there's a bunch of deleted scenes on the DVDs that you can check out that have like some next level gore. Yes. There are a couple things they had to like cut away to show like reaction shots or stuff like that in this movie where the original effect that was completely strategized and executed.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was funny. The guy on the news mentions two possible reasons for the events, both of which are different horror movies.
Uh-huh.
So he talks about like a possible comet going overhead,
right.
Radiation fallout, and I thought of Night of the Comet and Night of the Creeps.
Sure.
Night of the Creeps, I guess, speaks more to like the original, one of some of the original ideas they floated around was, you know, that aliens hosting in human bodies, that idea.
But Night of the Comet goes back to your radioactive shenanigans.
Yeah. I really like the zombie daughter this time around. In the first one, I think she gets by killing people because they're, you know, we talked about that sort of difficulty with the familiarity of these zombies. And in that, she is just like their daughter. Here, they've started doing like the dead eyes element. So the sort of signifier that the soul has left the body. This is no longer the person you've known and loved. And the daughter is like creepy and aggressive.
She is.
Yeah. So when she, you know, when she goes after mom, there's the great like homage blood spurt onto the trowel. The original Johnny from the 68 makes a cameo towards the end of the movie. He's wearing an eye patch and he's actually quoting the character from the first movie.
Are these things slow moving?
Yeah, they're dead. They're all messed up.
Warren!
They really are.
Meanwhile, he looks like a pilot.
They love...
A pirate.
They love eye patches. I don't know what it is about eye patches, but like...
I think it's a very quick, like, it's a very quick disguise. They're like, you know, you look, you're used to looking people in the eye.
It's
so
true.
If you've got like an immediate difference in that first glance, then yeah.
Then yeah, I guess. There used to be this Rowan Atkinson one-man show thing that he did one time, and he's pretending to play the drum set. It goes later on to it where he's being this actor, but he's in disguise, and he puts his hand over to be like an eye patch. And so then no one knows that it's Rowan Atkinson. It's like one of the funniest things ever.
So this one changes the end pretty dramatically,
yes.
Whereas the first one kind of gives you the gut punch with the epilogue, and Ben's demise is a really cruel one,
mm-hmm.
Where this one, Barbara finally commits to the plan that she's been talking about since shit first went down,
yeah.
And just like weaves through the lawn of zombies. And eventually, you know, seemingly finds the militia nearby and actually sleeps through the night. I thought that was kind of surprising. So when she awakes to find that, like, people have already wrangled zombies for, like, cruel games and sort of, like, you know, zombie fights, and they're hanging them from trees and using them as target practice.
Right.
Like, people have sunk low pretty quick in this.
Mm-hmm.
They're us. We're them, and they're us.
When she returns with the militia to the house, I think she's a little hopeful that she'll find somebody.
Do you think so?
I think so. I think that's why she goes back.
She's hoping to find Tony Todd.
Yeah. And so the end in this one is far more morose,
mm-hmm.
and tragic. I think I like the original ending more, but this one has a good punch also.
I do like the original ending more because that's my jam. I love endings like that. I think that it just comes out of nowhere, and it's sad as well in that one, but it's sad for different reasons, especially watching it now in this particular year. It's very sad to see the 68 version. But now, I don't know, the 1990, and this is... if I had a complaint between the two or I wanted to do some compare and contrast, I think the Romero leaves so much up to yourself to imagine,
mm-hmm.
and the Savini just puts it all out there on the table. So I think it depends on how you feel like watching it or how much you feel like thinking about it.
Yeah, there was a quote from one of the cast members of the original, like when they do these panels and they show up to cons, one of the guys said that we made a good movie. The fans have made it a great film.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was a really good way to encapsulate the idea that the fans are the ones who take in all the variables.
Right.
Who take in the context of the time it was made. And, you know, we talked about comic books and the idea of, like, reading between the panels.
Right, right.
And it's the fans filling in those details, making this movie great.
Right. And that's something I think as we've been doing this show and I started – kind of really thinking about certain things is like, I feel like I am getting better. The more I practice putting in these alternate or these like before stories, what is that? Like a backstory on these guys.
Okay.
The more then I can actually read into other, I think, things when I watch new movies and I can see like, mm-hmm. oh, the relationships. Like when we did Lost Boys a couple weeks ago, I thought, you know, I'm reading so much more into this Diane Wiest character than I would have, I think, previously.
The split, the divorce, everything that happens before.
Yeah. I think I just took it as face value. And so when I see the 68, it just gives me more, as a viewer and as a fan, it gives me more to ponder on my own.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, a great movie will sort of keep you thinking and going back to it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
On that note of, like, thinking about more to a film or more to these characters. I would definitely direct people to an article called Raising the Dead by Kyle Bishop. It's really good, and it goes into the Freud idea of the uncanny, talks about Simon Pegg a little bit. That's a great article. And then the one I previously mentioned from Cultural Critique, the chapter Philosophy of the Living Dead by James McFarland are definitely excellent reads to see more that you understand why things work, but this explains to you why it works. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah. The sort of that I always find it fascinating, the sort of psychological components that actually dictate what we're scared of, what we're relating to, mm-hmm. what we're reading into.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, cool. Yeah, man. Nerd it out. Okay, so that'll do it for this episode of The Rant Macabre. We're on all the social media.
Mm-hmm.
If you're listening to this, it means you are a Patreon subscriber, so thank you for that. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, at Rants Macabre. Our website is therantsmacabre.com.
Our regular show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play.
And you can contact us through the Patreon page, yep. or our email is therantsmacabre@gmail.com. Get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. We'd love to sort of keep these conversations going. And if you've got recommendations, there's, you know, a dozen and a half sort of remakes, different takes. There's the animated Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah.
I've only seen a little bit of that. But yeah, share what your favorite elements are. This is me, Darren, signing off.
And this is Mindy. Thanks.